Thank you, Stephen.
That was terrific. I wonder if people had comments or questions.
Do we have a roving mic? Yeah, Mike's got a mic.
While you're perhaps mulling it over, I wondered whether I could pick up that point, because you say, Stephen, that it's understanding the Dharma as a response to a particular historical period,
yeah,
from which we can learn a lot about the Dharma as a response to our times.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you were talking about some of these details, I was, you know, the question that was shaping in my mind was, why is this important? Why is it important that we have a deeper understanding of the historical Buddha? And I just wondered if actually both of you could mm-hmm. could talk about that. So maybe if John starts and then we'll turn to Stephen.
Okay. Well, I can speak very personally here. I mean, I think that the question for me is, do I want a mythological Buddha or do I want a flesh and blood Buddha of this period as much as we can reconstruct him? And I think the answer is I want more. Can't hear me. Okay, can you hear me now? Is this? Okay, let me say that again. I'm just saying I'm answering very personally here, which is that the question for me is, and in this work, is do I want a mythological Buddha? Somebody who speaks to me from a period of 2,500 years ago, who seems a kind of cipher for what we are trying to attempt to do in the 21st century, or do I want somebody who is flesh and blood, who I can relate to? For me, the answer is always I want somebody who's flesh and blood. I'm not interested in ciphers. And actually, one of the things I found of my own work, which is not quite the same as Stephen's, is more looking at the ideas that come from the culture as much as the life of the Buddha, but when I look at this figure who I call the Buddha, I find somebody far more interesting than the mythologies. Far more interesting than the mythologies. Somebody who speaks from real life dilemmas. Somebody who speaks from actually having backache, having dysentery, you know, has real human problems. Who even jokes in his latter years about his decrepitude. You know, it says in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, this, you know, this form is only kept going each day by being strapped up like an old cart. You know, he's joking to a certain degree about it. He has a sense of humour, sometimes which doesn't come across in our rather po-faced translations. He has a sense of humour. He makes fun of people. He's very much living in an age. Yet he's doing something quite remarkable. I think this is the thing that really inspired me. He's doing something remarkable, and he's doing it by that complete engagement with a society. As I said, I think in the conclusion to my own little bit about the Buddha's times, so one thing I get from the Buddha is this complete engagement with our society. How do we have a Dharma which is not rooted in 5th century BCE India with all the cultural accretions of 5th century BCE India? To understand some of those teachings, it's necessary to understand some of that 5th century BCE India, to see the problems he's dealing with, actually sometimes just to have the humour of the jokes he's making about stuff, which actually, although there's very great differences between obviously that period and our own period, somehow still makes its way through into thought forms that we have in the 21st century. You know, we might call it by different names. You know, the Buddha is engaging with something which is very much rooted in his own culture, which is something called Atman, self. Doesn't quite have the same connotations as it has in our society, but we all understand what being a self is, being an ego. These thoughts and being immutable in some way, these thoughts find their way into our contemporary thinking quite easily. We have to engage with them, though, in the 21st century. And I think, for me, that's what's really important about this kind of work. And in a sense, it's digging away and finding out the depth of that engagement to see how we can do it, almost as a model for what we can do in this society in forming a form of Buddhism, which I think which is appropriate to the society we live in.
As John was speaking, he started with a question, you know, do I want a mythological Buddha or do I want a flesh and blood Buddha? and said, I want a flesh and blood one. I agree, so do I. But I think it's worth dwelling on that point. Why? What is it within us that wants that?
Yeah.
And you see, Buddhism, for the whole of its history, pretty much, has not really wanted a flesh and blood Buddha. It's actually mythologized the Buddha into this kind of weird sort of 32 major marks, this kind of quasi-god who's omniscient, who's, you know, really nothing like a human being at all. And that has been satisfying for most Buddhists throughout the last 2,500 years, as far as we can make out. So I think this quest for a flesh and blood Buddha is also saying something about us. And my hunch is that we are looking for a gospel narrative. We are coming from a Christian or post-Christian culture, whatever you call it, in which we're brought up to, when you read the Gospels, you can't imagine the Gospels being stripped of the life of Jesus and just the teachings left. The life constitutes the teaching. Jesus' passion, his whole existence in his time and place is as much part of the gospel, the good news, as is what he says. And so I think we're coming at it from a Christian perspective. I don't think that's a problem, because I think that's what has happened in all Buddhist cultures, especially those outside India. They've sought to understand, to relate to a Buddha who speaks to their condition at their time. Let's say in China, the Buddha becomes more a kind of a Taoist sage, if you wish. So what I find particularly useful in this exercise is that rather than paying attention just to what is recorded as to what the Buddha said, which is of course important, we can also start to pay more attention to what the Buddha did, to actually take his the stories about him and his various interactions with his people as a way of embodying and articulating the Dharma, even when no words are spoken. And it's quite curious, in the early texts, you don't have the Buddha giving lots of talks about love and compassion. But what you do find is a life that is constantly lived as a life of love and compassion. It comes through in his deeds, not in his words. And another aspect of this, as John alluded to this himself, is that by getting a clearer understanding of the context within which these Buddhist teachings were given, we can start to tease apart what is simply a response to, let's say, Brahmanical rituals, and what is a response to universal human suffering, universal human experience. And I think it's very crucial for our times that we differentiate what the Buddha, what is attributed to the Buddha, that is in fact very much couched in the language and the culture of that period, as opposed to those other teachings that we find attributed to the Buddha that seem to speak directly to us today. In other words, to pass the cultural and the historical elements of his teaching from the universal elements. And I don't quite see how we can do that without gaining a clear understanding of the 5th century BCE India. I'm not suggesting that, you know, everybody now has just become a historian, but there are plenty of good scholars, historians like Richard Gombrich and others, who are doing this work for us. And it's an incredible service, because it's allowing us to focus more clearly on what is original and distinctive in the Buddha's teaching that speaks across time and space to our condition today, which is the human condition. I don't think human beings have changed significantly at all since the Buddha's time. We're still, I mean, if they had, what the Buddha says in these texts simply wouldn't address our condition. It wouldn't be interesting. It'd be like reading a prayer to the Egyptian god Ra, which probably for most of us would be kind of curious but not terribly relevant. What's amazing, really, as also I think in particularly the so-called world religions, is that the teachings speak to something beyond the context in which they were originally given, but in order to identify those, we need to understand that context in order to bracket it off.
I mean, you know, what's going through my mind is that this is exactly the process that Christianity went through in the 19th century. And there was that search for the historical Jesus.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I just wondered whether either of you could sort of briefly do that sort of comparison between Buddhism and Christianity. I'm wondering whether that search for the historical Jesus, in what way did that disrupt or change or reform Christianity? Because this is, I mean, it's very interesting that Islam has really struggled to do the same historical process around the Prophet. I don't know if either of you wanted to draw some sort of broader context to this about.
Well, I've been very influenced in my own studies by the work of Christian scholars. As Madeline has said, the search for the historical Jesus began about the latter part of the 19th century. People like David Strauss, Schweitzer also was into this. And more recently, the work of the Jesus Seminar in the United States, Robert Funk and other scholars, who are doing incredible work in figuring out and giving us a very vivid picture of Jesus in his time and place. I read a very good book recently by José Pagola, who's a Catholic scholar in Spain, called Jesus, a Historical Approximation. And what he's trying to do is very, very similar to the sort of work I'm interested in doing with the Buddha. So I've learnt an enormous amount, and I think it has had a similar impact in Christianity. It's brought Jesus down from his rather exalted heights and rendered him fully human. And that's the stream within Christianity that I can also deeply identify with. And I think as Buddhist scholars, we have an enormous gratitude. I have an enormous gratitude to the work that the Christian community have been doing over the last 150 years ago. And I quite unabashedly see my own work as following in their footsteps.
I probably wouldn't have that influence. I mean, whilst familiar with some of this material, it certainly hasn't been an influence particularly on my approach to it. Mine has been much, much more rooted within understanding the kind of intellectual tradition around the time of the Buddha, as well as the Buddha's actual life story. I think clarifying that intellectual milieu that the Buddha lived in is enormously helpful for all of us, again for reasons which I've already covered. It's enormously helpful to actually begin to tease apart some of these teachings, and I think the point Stephen was making, to find out what is cultural, to sift out the cultural chaff from the real wheat of the teaching itself, which applies to our condition now. Now, some of that is so deeply embedded in the metaphors that it sometimes takes you a long time, just if you look at a parallel between, I don't know, some Hindu texts, such as some of the Upanishads and some of the Pali texts, to even begin to see by analysis of language the parallels that are going on and the ideas that the Buddha's playing with. I don't find exact parallels of that going on in Christian in Christian theology, basically, and Christian understandings of this. It's also an enormous task, as you probably gather, because of the simple size of the literature that we're dealing with in Indian literature. We're not dealing with four Gospels, we're dealing with a huge quantity of Sutta material. Some of it's readily spottable, and others are really deeply embedded. You can basically pick out the Buddha's teaching in some of this material, and other times you've got to really do sort of textual archaeology on it to find it. Mm-hmm. But it is for what's illuminating about what is cultural, what is useful to us in the 21st century.
Are there any comments or questions? Oh, good. We've given you a bit of time to think about them. Okay, so I didn't see all those hands, so you'll need to put some more hands up. I think there were some people back there. But we'll start here at the front, and we'll take a few questions, if that's all right.
Mm-hmm, fine.
Just to give you because there's quite a few people that want to speak.
How can either of you speak with such
Did you hear it? Can you hear at the back?
You may have to speak up again.
Yeah.
Could I not be heard?
No, they could. That's good. They could hear.
Yeah.
I wondered if your question was going to stop there.
Since I'll begin again, how can either of you, very learned gentlemen, speak with such complete confidence, masquerading almost as authority of a largely pre-literate society? John Peacock, you spoke deliberately provocatively of Grotemer as a radical in the sense of a social radical. Mm-hmm. What, pray, is the Pali word for radical in that sense? What is the Sanskrit word? Is there a word in any Indian language that suggests that people at that time even had the dumbest perception of the notion of radical political radicalism as we understand it? I suggest that this is a complete ahistorical and anachronistic imposition on ancient peoples of concepts which mean great things to us and would mean nothing whatever to them. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you finished the question.
The notion which Stephen Batchelor, Mr. Batchelor, telling us about the reality of the society which Gautama inhabited, and contrasting it with the ahistoricism of the Mahayana account of things. Quite true. Does he mean to suggest that people of Gautama's time really had a sense of history?
No.
Well, that seems to be the implication. But you're contrasting the Mahayana account, and I agree with you, it is entirely as lacking in a sense of history, as distinct from myth. I'm unconvinced by that. I'm not aware of a continuous story of actual society distinguished from mythical accounts of this period in history, and that's certainly not in the mouth of Indians. There's a lack of tentativeness about both of you, which fails to persuade me of the duly cautious conclusions of real scholars. You argue very little by reference to detailed evidence. You cite, if at all, merely in order to claim a preconceived idea of how things were or are. You can certainly cite Gombrich in passing because he's a real scholar. But bring him out there. Your arguments are largely speculative. Well, so we go to this. If only he'd admitted it. If only you would, we could then engage with the dialogue speculatively and develop it for today's conditions.
Great.
Great,
thank you. So there's a few more questions. I think if we go back several rows, there was two gentlemen.
Lady here,
yes, sorry, lady there, maybe do the microphone. If you could keep your hand in the air, then they can see where
the chap and her.
Okay. Sorry, I'll get around to you because of. Yeah.
Just. Should be fine.
So, you can remember how to respond to all of that.
I've got the gist.
I'm not very good at this. I'm not an intellectual. I'm just interested, can we allow the perception of the Buddha as a living person, which I've always related to coexist alongside the idea of the Buddha as a more mythological figure? With the 32 marks and all the attributes and so on. Are both those perceptions useful to us as practicing Buddhists? And is there some echo of this, I wonder, in the Christian teaching of the Trinity? I don't know. I'd be interested to hear what your comments on those ideas are.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we'll take one more question on this round because it's quite...
I'm rather reluctant to ask anything after the first comments, but I can always fall to you to ask this question. It's a question which is very much on my mind, and since the idea of today is to try and get to the actual historical person of Gautama himself, there's an aspect that I wonder whether any thought or consideration has been given to. It seems to me that in some respects, some of the ideas that he puts forward, for example, detachment and a very empirical, logical approach to his ideas, his thinking, pretty much fit in to narcissistic personality disorder or even psychopathy. That is not a facile or a superficial comment, but it is a very real psychological view of the thinking that I see demonstrated. That is by no means an anti-Buddhist idea, but I'm just wondering if we know anything more or we can speculate more on the actual personality of the Buddha that might have led to that. We talk about religion having developed an omniscient view of the Buddha, but I wonder how much he contributed to that.
Did you say omniscient?
Yes.
Hmm.
Do you want to start picking up those three different comments?
Well, first of all, the nature of giving a public presentation in an audience like this is that one wishes to make a point. And if I were speaking in a different setting or writing something, then I would give far more technical references, but frankly, I don't think it's appropriate here. The other thing I would pick up on is the idea of a pre-literate culture, which I think is almost invariably thought of in the West as somehow inferior. And I think there's a danger that we impose our literary conceits on oral traditions. I actually have much more confidence in the reliability of oral transmissions than I used to. And again, I think the examples I gave at the very end of the talk show that two oral traditions, and there's many, many other examples of this, particularly between the Chinese and the Pali, show the reliability of such transmissions of ideas, even though they weren't written down. I don't find that a problem. Of course, what I'm saying is, from a strictly scholastic point of view, speculative. I agree. I don't dispute that. But I think it's a form of inquiry that I personally find enormously helpful, not as a scholar, and this I think is perhaps the difference between what we may be doing and what Professor Gombrich and others are doing, is that we're also practitioners. And to me, these texts, I don't approach these texts with the sort of cold objectivity of the professional philologist, for whom what is being said does not actually speak directly to their ultimate concerns, but is really just an archaeological, historical piece of text that needs to be coldly analysed. I can't do that, I'm afraid. These texts are of interest to me because they address my deepest concerns. And the discourse that I feel that we're trying to evolve in a contemporary Buddhist culture is one that respects the rigour of the scholarly analysis of materials and at the same time allows that approach to enable these texts to speak to our own condition more directly. Now, your point was about the lady.
Could
here.
You have a sort of relationship with the pathological
with the two different,
and the human?
Yeah, of course. And you see, I think we inherit a richness of 2,500 years of tradition. Some of that is going to speak to us; other aspects will not. And different people in the West will relate to these different narratives in different ways. And I don't have a problem with that at all. I think, you know, there's quite a good case to be made of developing a contemporary Buddhist mythology and teasing out the symbolism of these figures and so on. It's not personally what I'm interested in doing, but I think it's an entirely legitimate approach. As for the personality of the Buddha, that is very, very difficult to get at. It really is difficult. It's something that in all of the studies I've been doing and my close reading of these texts is that I constantly feel that the Buddha is always just beyond my reach. It's a funny feeling, a bit like Tantalus, you know, reaching for the grapes that then recede. And I've gone, done pilgrimages to all the places where he lived and taught. I've read these texts and looked at the historical. I'm yearning to find the answer to your question, but it always eludes me.
Okay, I feel like saying ditto, however. With those cases, I do think it's one of the exigencies. I will repeat something Stephen said, that was perhaps a slightly different way. I think it's one of the exigencies of giving these types of presentations, that one sounds a little bit more definite about a lot of this material. I stand by, although it is a contemporary word, you will not find a word for it in Pali and Sanskrit, radicality. You won't find that there. You will find words for historicity in there. Doesn't quite mean the same things. Yes, words like itihasa, for example, in Pali, in Sanskrit, which describes some kind of oral history. So it doesn't exactly map on. However, I will stand by my claim that, you know, looked at in terms of understanding the Buddha's culture as much as we can, and certainly everything I said, although I might have said it in a very forceful way without giving all the references, can certainly be easily verified by looking at works by, you know, scholars who really looked at Indian culture and pieced it together, you know, from the 19th century onwards. This has been an ongoing project of actually trying to piece together what Indian society looked like. Interestingly enough, the Pali Canon is one of our best tools for getting an insight into what Indian culture was like, the stratification of that culture, the way India was formed, the kind of ideas that were around. A lot of it is stylized, but we can still piece together a fairly clear picture. That, together with some of the iconography in places like Ajanta, yeah, for example, you might get another area of this which would confirm some of the things. But above all, I think, you know, we do have the textual material which gives us a very, I wouldn't say a very clear picture, gives us a very good indication of what Indian society may have been like. Now, I think with any enterprise of this sort, where we're looking back, say, at the Rig Vedic texts, possibly 1500 BCE, some of them are a lot earlier, you know, a lot later than that, but some of the earliest parts of those texts may be that. To the kind of texts that are around in the Buddha's time, like the, you know, for the Aranyakas, for example, which again give a certain image of what the breakaway groups were like, those Samana traditions. Jain traditions is much more difficult to know about because a lot of those texts have been lost. The sense were reconstructed much, much later. So I would actually stand by some of my comments I made, although I may have made them a little bit more forcibly than some people would like, because I think some of it is very well confirmed by a lot of the evidence that is around. And also, I have a kind of schizophrenic existence, because I'll give public talks like this, but I'll also engage in the kind of work that you're talking about, which is philological detective work of tracking down what's going on in these texts. But I think the real point that Stephen made, which is very important, I think what distinguishes myself, and always has been distinguished my approach to this, has always been to have a practitioner's eye about this. Because I kind of stumbled into academia, and we're going to history, but I kind of stumbled into academia and ended up, you know, as a practitioner, finding myself in academia, but still wanting to use the academic approach as a much more rigorous way of articulating forms of practice for the Western contemporary world. Yeah.
Since I'm being denied the microphone by your chair, to which I object strenuously, it's a form of suppression of my right of free speech, to which I object seriously. It's not just a joke. I don't see why I should submit to that. I will simply speak without it. What I wanted to say was thank you. That's a much more qualified account than what you were saying before, and it approaches to some degree the kind of tentativeness which I can duly respect, instead of the dogmatism I've seen occur.
Thank you.
Did you want to also comment on the question about the Buddha?
I know we've got a comment on the other question about, you know, the flesh and blood Buddha versus the mythological Buddha. I think it depends. I think it very much depends on what you want to use it for. I mean, traditionally we've always had this aspect of Buddhism which is usually translated as faith within it. Now, within Mahayana traditions, that's been also a very, very important dimension to it. And the mythological Buddha has been very important to the development of faith within that. Slightly taking it back to the more flesh and blood, what I tend to do, again, it's slightly speculative, but it's taking that translation of faith, which is the Pali word sadha or shraddha in Sanskrit, and taking it back to one of its etymologies, which is actually to have develop confidence or trust. The flesh and blood leaves you with much more sort of something you can have trust in, whereas I think the Mahayana aspect has something which is much more perhaps similar to some of the theistic traditions of having faith in. Yeah, and I think there are two different feeling tones attached to those. I think it's two very different feeling tones attached to those. Both are, I wouldn't want to deny one or elevate the other. I think it depends on what you're approaching, what works for you, what really inspires you, and this is end as a practitioner comment, what inspires you to engage in that practice.
Both in tandem?
And it could be both in tandem. It might be both, yeah. I don't see any reason why that should be a particular problem. Dealing with personality of the Buddha, I can't really add much to what Steve has said. The personality of the Buddha is absolutely impossible to know. One gets a certain impression, I wouldn't say a sense of his personality. It gets an impression of what that personality would be like. Sometimes I think, I don't know if Stephen sees it at all, I don't think he tolerates certain questions very easily. Yeah? He does really put people in their place very quickly. Other times he engages in banter. He twists people's words deliberately, if we're to believe these texts, which is an oral tradition. But, I don't want to cite the big Richard Gombrich again, but as Richard says sometimes, that when we see these jokes and these kinds of banter, they probably are realistic. There was actually no reason to leave those in the early texts. They didn't do anything about the production of the teaching or the message that was coming through. Because they're entirely related to the culture and the particular time that they're engaged in. The other point he makes, which I think is a very good one, committees don't make very good jokes. And the people who are engaged in creating these recensions, these different recensions, probably didn't engage in that sort of thing.
Forgive me if I sounded provocative. Yeah. I'm acting as Mara's advocate.
Yeah.
You know, you wrote a whole book about Mara. Yeah. Particularly because I'm very curious about the parallels between, if you look at narcissistic personality disorder, psychopathy, and many of the ideas.
I'm sorry, it sounds it's just
very similar.
I think there's quite a lot of other questions. So it would be good to get some other people into the conversation. So if you could put your hands back up, because I know that, so there's a gentleman at the end of that row, and then at the other end of the row. And are there any more? If you could just,
Okay,
so this sort of. Exactly. There's about three there. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. My question is a bit
pressuring
my mind 10 minutes ago, so forgive me if this is a bit stumbling. But it concerns this relationship concerns this idea of the flesh and blood or the cipher. And there seems to be a desire for the flesh and blood over the cipher, which I question. I have a bit of an issue with this. It seems to imply a slightly difficult relationship to, well, on one hand, you have the sort of complex and inaccessible object of a person, or the complex and accessible object of a text. And there seems to be kind of a desire for this kind of what you use the symbol of Tantalus and the grapes, and what recedes, what kind of, what exceeds the grasp. And I wonder about the kind of desire for the flesh and blood or the historical person, particularly in terms of the, what you talked about in terms of the leaking of the asanas, in terms of ignorance, desire, opinions. So I wonder, is this desire for the flesh and blood rooted in something that might perhaps be best avoided?
Oh, sorry.
Maybe just switch it off and
yeah.
shout.
Yeah. yeah.
I wonder if this one. Do you want to take this one? Okay. Is that
dangerous?
Can you?
No, you
can. Yeah. I firstly want to say that I'm grateful to both of you for your words and for your work, because when I first approached Buddhism, I found a lot of it felt like it was trying to deceive me in some way or propel me towards some sort of guilt or frustration of some kind and so on. So a lot of it didn't sit very comfortably with me, but your interpretations and so on do. And I was wondering if either currently or whatever, that there are parts of either your practice or you're looking into currently that don't sit so comfortably with you in terms of how you're trying to interpret them in their life and so on. I'd be intrigued to hear
I'm not sure clear.
What is it about our practice, did you say, that don't sit comfortably, or what we read in the text that doesn't sit comfortably?
How those two interact in terms of when you are possibly discovering something afresh in terms of what we're reading about, and how, because you've been talking about how that...
Can you keep using the microphone?
Sure. How what you're studying and reading about and so on, what you're discovering at times, sometimes afresh, and that which then goes on to inform your practice, if any of that does not sit. Because it sounds like all of it sits very comfortably with your ears.
I understand, that's good.
Okay.
That's
okay. Okay, and there was a couple of hands, I think, up in the middle. Was it just one?
We're down to one mic now, because I think they're going to react.
Okay, hello. In there's been some recent scholarly works and also popular works about theories about Jesus being a mythological character, also about Muhammad perhaps not having been an historical character. I wondered what it was that clinched for you the idea that the Buddha definitely was, because certainly in these two cases of Jesus and Muhammad, I think the arguments are quite strong that they may have been entirely mythological.
Any other questions or comments? Stunned into silence.
Okay. Do you want? Shall I go? Or
you go.
Okay. Well, I think it's important just to emphasise that my particular interests and preoccupations are driven by my own passions and concerns, and the flesh and blood Buddha is something for which I, since I went to India in 2003 and did the Buddhist pilgrimage circuit, in fact I went as to take photographs actually for somebody else, but that started a quest for me. Suddenly this figure that I'd read about in these texts was located in a geographical reality. It kind of earthed the whole experience for me in a very sort of visceral, somatic way. And I think my quest for the historical Buddha is coming as much out of that kind of somatic intuition of place, of atmosphere, of plants, of birdsong, of rice fields that I encountered on these trips, as it is from, let's say, a purely intellectual exercise. So it's coming very much as a bodily quest. And you may be right. Possibly it's I'm chasing after chimera. Yeah, I'm chasing after a shadow. It could be. But when these kinds of ideas and teachings are something that is very central to one's life as a practitioner, then I'm reluctant just to ignore those intuitions and those felt senses. And I hope the Dharma helps you learn to trust which intuitions to follow. And I found this a very rich seam to mine. Going to your point, there's plenty in the Pali Canon that drives me bananas and doesn't sit at all happily with the kind of version of the Buddha and his teachings that I'm trying to articulate. If you just sit down and you open one several hundred page volume of suttas and just start reading from beginning to end, I find stuff there that is very world denying. There's a lot of heavy duty renunciation. To the point I can remember sometimes actually wanting to throw the bloody book out of the window. It really drives me nuts, that whole side of things.
Where does that all come from? That?
Well, I think, my sense, I think the whole renunciation thing comes because the early Buddhist community, many of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis who were drawn to this culture, were identified quite strongly with the Indian ascetic and renunciant tradition. And that was simply their culture. It was simply what drove them to do what they did. And that, I think, has become the dominant narrative in what has been remembered, because the people who did the remembering happened to be people like that. So, of course, they'll remember the bits that speak mostly to that speak most directly to their concerns. But I think probably what John and I are looking for are the remaining fragments of something that possibly predated that emphasis on renunciation. Of course, you'll find the Buddha saying this stuff, but it doesn't speak to me. In fact, it rather turns me off. It doesn't. So that's a struggle. I find that my editor, one of the publishing houses I used to work at, would sometimes spot a passage in a book and say, "Oh, come on, Stephen, this is just your private battle with Buddhism," and it's true. I think there is a kind of, there's a love-hate relationship with a lot of this material. And the last point was... I'm aware of this material, and it's been an issue that has dogged both the Christian scholarship and Buddhist scholarship. I don't know about Islamic scholarship, probably since the 19th century. It keeps going back and forth. You get the mythological strand becomes emphasized, then there's a counter movement to the more historical, and it goes back and forth. And so, if one is to keep an open mind, and I hope at times at least I manage to do that, then I have to be open to both possibilities. But from the work that I've done and the work that I've, come across from other scholars whom I respect, I really find it very hard to explain that the Buddha was just a mythological creation. It just doesn't, to me, make sense. I just cannot. In order to believe that, I'd have to believe in a massive and complicated conspiracy theory to produce a bunch of texts which are a complete mess, and yet when you pick them apart, are utterly consistent and coherent. If it were just a mythological creation, one would have imagined, a bit like, say, Krishna or Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita. You don't have the question, these are not historical figures, as far as one can make out. But the Buddha and his followers don't come across in that guise at all. So that would be my current position on that. But I think we have to leave this as an ongoing and open question.
Yes, okay, my response is, again, I'm tempted to say ditto to quite a lot of it, but I did actually admit to being a very personal view in searching.
You might have to speak a bit closer to
me. Yeah, sorry. I did actually admit to my own personal looking for a flesh and blood Buddha. It does, I think, as Stephen quite rightly echoed in relationship to himself, depends on your passions for this material. The more passionate I've got about this material over the years, and I've been involved with this for an awful long time, the more interested I have become in the historicity of what's going on, simply because it brings a culture and a place to life. And sometimes, again, I don't know with Stephen, but sometimes when I'm reading through some passages, now a lot of it's very stylized, it's been worked over tremendously. But I've been involved, and still am, I kind of do a little bit every so often, I'm involved in translating a Sutta Nipata, which is a very, very early text. And some of the aspects of that text just leap out at you as being the sayings of somebody who probably, these were very close formulations to probably something that was really said by a flesh and blood figure. Now, whether it was the Buddha is very dubious, hence I will be tentative about that. Nobody can say exactly where these sayings come from. They might even come from earlier sources, who knows? But there is something very living about it, and perhaps it is not just looking at the one person, perhaps it's looking at a living tradition, something that was very much alive, very, very vibrant. Actually, India, I'd love to have been a fly on the wall in 5th century BCE India to see what was going on, to see how close our approximations are, what was actually happening. I think it would be absolutely fascinating. It was a world of, as far as we can understand, it's a world of ferment. A lot of, I think, these conditions that we see even in contemporary culture, political uncertainty, unrest, religious problems, you know, all going on in 5th century BCE India. And there was this seeming figure who was there. And I personally, perhaps I put it a little bit too strongly, but I did own it. I would actually say I'm just interested to know a little bit more about this figure who seemed to walk through this period at that particular time. I'll answer the question that you asked about, is there anything that makes me uncomfortable? Yes, I mean, all the sort of things that Stephen said. Yes, there's a lot of stuff that makes me uncomfortable. There's an awful lot of the Pali Canon, which just doesn't fit in with, and I, again, admit it, my view of what Buddhism is about. Sometimes I'll even go too far as to say, well, I think if he's using it in that way, it must be a metaphor. It's not meant as being real. And I'm always aware at the back of my mind this nagging thought that perhaps this stuff is just the way it was. You know, this was the sort of things that he believed. But outside
of that... Can you give us a concrete example of that?
I think the classic ones are all the mentions of rebirth within the text. I mean, I'll quite often say, well, and I'll give you the kind of argument I make. I don't think it's completely absurd, but I'll say it anyway, which is, you know, basically the Buddha tends to try and give mechanisms for everything he talks about, or this figure who we call the Buddha, tends to try and give mechanisms for everything he talks about, particularly if they're really important. So there are massive discussions of psychological states, a whole discussion, actually, which, you know, amazed some of my colleagues at Oxford, where I work, when I was speaking about the cognitive chain, the cognitive chain of unfolding here. And they're saying, well, actually, that really quite looks, we could map this onto what we understand these days. Yet, when it comes to rebirth, there's an absolute silence about the mechanism. It takes later texts, such as the Abhidharma, to try and fill in that hole within it. They create terms and all sorts of things to explain that mechanism. And I say, well, in that case, I tend to think perhaps he's using it as a metaphor, you know, a metaphor for psychological becoming, you know, because there's a lot of that, and that's justified by later texts as well, which actually say that isn't so far from it. But there is also this literal sense. So there's a kind of metaphysical and the literal come together within it. Yet, there's something for me within the text which I think is far more important as a practitioner. The more I read these texts, and I'm not talking about these uncomfortable examples of the bits I don't particularly agree with and like, but I'm talking about the basic teachings. And I often say this, actually, to students. If there's something that you don't find unsettling about what the Buddha is saying here, sometimes you're just not hearing it. You know, because actually there is something rather unsettling. You know, okay, we can intellectualize it and we can take on this stuff on board very easily, some of it. Even the teaching which seems to be most complex, anatta, not self, you know, actually isn't that difficult to get an intellectual grasp on if you apply yourself to it. Yet, if that somehow doesn't make you feel slightly uncomfortable, then it's not working. And actually, I think one of the things that makes me still feel really uncomfortable, and I talk about it endlessly when I teach retreats, is impermanence. If we somehow don't really find that uncomfortable, we've just kind of intellectualised it. Oh yeah, I know it's impermanence. Yes, I understand that. You know, really hearing it, I think ought to add to your discomfort. The Buddha was not, as from my reading, he was not a purveyor of consolation. He was, you know, the contemporary phrase, he was telling you how it is. You know, And actually that can be very disconcerting, because a lot of the time we don't want it like it is. And he points that out as well.
Yeah. Well, that's a really good point to end, I think. Disconcerted. many thanks for all your questions, and I think we should give a round of applause for Stephen and John, who I think have...